The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start.
3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Friday morning Space Show program. This is a classroom Space Show program format, which I'll explain in just a minute. But thank you for joining us. Great to be here. And let's get into the announcements. If you would like to call us, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also do email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do visit our website, which is thespaceshow.com. So we have a comprehensive newsletter there in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. All of the week's bios are there in full, program details. This is where we have a future events section for what's coming up in the Space Show world. And also, if we do need to get an announcement out or change something, this is where you find it first. So do check it from time to time. And everything we do is archived, and you can easily download the programs or just listen to them off of our website going back to 2001. We're approaching 2,000 programs. And you will see also next to the social media buttons a guest search button. So here you can do global searches for your favorite guest or space term like the moon. Find out all of the programs and their dates where those items have been mentioned, and then you can go back to our website and pull those programs up by date. There's a Space Show store called Gear up at the top of the website. Please do check it out. Of course, the most important button there is a Support the Space Show button. We are a nonprofit 501c3 with one GiantLeapFoundation.org, and the program could not exist without your contributions and support, and we certainly do appreciate and thank those of you who have supported us and will be supporting us in the future. And if you like the Space Show and its programs, all of which you can access and download for free, support us and help us stay around for a while longer. And we definitely do appreciate that. Do remember we're trademarked and copyrighted. And here are the rules. And these were just, again, recently violated, and I found out about it. And it's a mess when you guys edit shows, take audio clips, put them in your books, and then try to make money on it. This is not allowed with our trademark and copyright, and we will enforce it. So, again, no edits, no private YouTube channels, nothing at all commercial. You're certainly free to quote from the program in a paper, a research book, or something like that. Just use a traditional academic citation for multimedia. And you're certainly welcome to do that. If you have any other ideas, contact me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and see if we can work it out. That's a lot better than having your project, which maybe has already gone to print, stopped for copyright violation. And as I said, we do enforce our copyrights and our trademarks, and we protect our guests who are fine with our audio shows, but written transcripts and doing other things with it and making money off of it, that's a no-no for us as well as what we have in agreement with our guests. We do podcast, and that is on gigadial.net, but we're in iTunes, and we're in a host of other places, Podcast Alley, Microsoft Zoom. If you have any podcasting questions, let us hear from you, okay? And we do answer all of our mail, so we will do our best to get back to you. Remember, please, that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security For more information, you can visit their website, which is www.swfound.org. They are also the sponsors of our webinar programs, and we certainly value our relationship with Secure World. They do great work, and you all ought to visit their website and check it out. That brings me to our classroom program today, which is a two-hour format with a break at the top of the hour. And for listeners who want to email or call the show, the big difference in a classroom format is you really have to be succinct in your question, either in writing, in email, or on the phone. But you also have to follow our discussion and make your question or comment pertinent to what we're discussing. You can't go off in left field and talk about something that we're not talking about. So please honor those simple rules, and we'll all go off into the weekend very, very happy and fulfilled, because our two guests today are really, really super duper, especially on the topic we're going to talk about. First, I'll introduce Dr. Paul Spudas. Those of you who are frequent listeners know Paul. He's been a guest on the show many, many times. He's a senior staff scientist with the Lunar and Planetary Institute, which is in Houston. He specializes in research on the histories of and the processes on the terrestrial planets. And he has served on NASA's Lunar and Planetary Sample Team, which advises allocations of lunar samples for scientific research, Lunar Exploration Science Working Group, and much, much more. His website, which is SpudasLunarResources.com, has his new blog on it. His old blog is also still in existence. We'll talk about that as the show progresses. And Paul has been on the show a lot over the past couple of years, talking about our subject today, cislunar space development. Also with us is Dr. Jim Vetta, and he's returning. He was recently on the show regarding his brand new book, Becoming Spacefarers, Rescuing America's Space Program. Dr. Vetta has been with the Aerospace Corporation in Arlington, Virginia since 2004. He does outstanding policy research and analysis for different government agencies and customers, including NASA, the FAA, Department of Commerce, Air Force, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and others. And before that, he spent 6.5 years at Answer, Inc., which is also in Arlington, assigned full-time to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And as I said, he was recently on his program for his book, and he has also been talking about and promoting cislunar space development, and it was a big part of our program when he was on a few weeks ago regarding his book, Becoming Spacefarers. Gentlemen, welcome to the program, and I guess I'd like to start out, and each of you, starting with you, Jim, tell us how you see space with cislunar development, and why it should be the priority or the top two or three priorities in our civil space program.
Well, it's great to be back on the program, and especially to talk about something that we feel is such an important topic here, and will help us to set the direction of the future of our spaceflight program. Let me start by saying that my going-in assumption, and you can call it a goal statement if you wish, is that we're exploring and developing space as a long-term endeavor. It's not just a passing fad, like some skeptical writers have said. It's we're in it for the long haul, and the purpose is to add value to the human condition in a variety of ways. And, of course, those ways include scientific, economic, societal benefits of various kinds, and even for some philosophical and spiritual benefits. So there are many purposes to all of this that we're trying to accomplish. And I've been thinking for a long time about what is the best approach to doing this. How do we get there quickly, efficiently, with the resources that we have available to us? And the conclusion that I came to many years ago is that the destination-driven approach that we have been pursuing traditionally is not going to serve us well to achieve that goal and to do it within available resources. So we have to analyze what's wrong with that process and what we can replace it with. The problem that we have with a destination-driven program is that we tend to have a focus on the narrow goal of getting from here to there and back, and little or no strategy associated with that about consolidating our gains along the way. So we have to consider the, as the economists would call it, the opportunity cost of, well, if we spend all of our time and resources on this type of destination-driven achievement, then we will not have enough left over to actually consolidate what we have and turn it into an ongoing, sustainable, purposeful activity that will bring all of these benefits that that I mentioned, that I alluded to. So so you have to consider that the way to do this is something you can reach back into history and see that this is one of the things that history has a lot to teach us, even though the space environment is such a different place to develop. History can teach us some things, and we need to look back and see that capabilities are what moved us outward and actually established us by the creation of infrastructure and the development of ongoing operations, allowing us to do more and more over time. Those accomplishments didn't happen until the infrastructure was established. Well, in the case of space development, the sensible way to proceed is to develop that infrastructure in cislunar space. You have to learn how to behave up there, how to establish communities, how to do things that will last and that will pay off in various ways over a period of time that will allow you to take all of that experience and all of that technological development and then build outward. If we have a program, in contrast to that, that merely looks at the solar system as a series of targets, each one of increasing distance, then we will not be achieving what we want, especially if we have an experience repeated like we had with Apollo, where you go a couple of generations before there's any follow-up. We will have development just in spurts, and we will get ourselves to the point where, as John Marburger, President Bush's science advisor, pointed out back in about 2008, we could look back after 100 years and see that all we had was an array of monuments strewn around on planets and moons around the solar system, but nothing else to show for it. So developing cislunar space is the first step to moving out to the rest of the solar system, and it's not the slow track that some people might think. It's actually the fast track, because you will learn how to do things consistently to move out with some type of purpose and continuous activity that brings all sectors of space players on board, rather than just have these occasional spurts of activity that don't really consolidate the gains that you make over time. So your bottom line is, if you want the quickest, most efficient way to move out into the solar system and explore and develop, it's not jumping from planet to planet in some type of athletic demonstration of what we can do. It is building outward, starting with cislunar space. So I'll leave it at that and turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Jim. Paul, how do you see it?
Well, thank you, David, for having me on the show again. It's good to be here. And I think Jim's pretty well summed up the top-level view of this, that fundamentally what you want to create is an incremental, increasing extent of human reach. Right now, our reach goes as far as LEO, as low Earth orbit. And what we want to do is we want to go beyond LEO for a variety of different purposes. So just to kind of sum up where I'm coming from, my contention is that space actually has benefits to society in many areas, and it's not simply the inspirational power of exploration or the emotional excitement of seeing a human on another world. It's the fact that we now know how to use space to create new capabilities, to create wealth. And it turns out that initially in space, most of that economic capability comes from satellite assets. And these satellites are mostly in orbits beyond low Earth orbit. They are in orbits that are in middle Earth orbit, in geosynchronous orbit, in highly elliptical orbits, and at the L points. All of these points are sort of in the volume of space that is, that's encompassed by Earth and Moon, and that's what we call cislunar space. Now, the current paradigm of spaceflight is that we, when we envision an application or a mission, we custom design a spacecraft. We can build it using the custom design. It's launched on an expendable vehicle. It's positioned to where it should be for whatever its mission is. It's operated for a while, and then it's abandoned. And so that paradigm of custom design, launch an expendable, use and throw away, and then repeat is sort of what's keeping us back in space, because fundamentally we're lifting everything that we need out of the deepest gravity well in the solar system. And as long as we are limited to that kind of operational paradigm, we will always be capability limited. Because we're mass and power limited in what we can lift out of this gravity well, we are therefore capability limited in areas of space beyond LEO. Because the fundamental problem is the rocket equation means that you reach LEO with empty fuel tanks. So there's only two ways around that. You can either bring up a fueled stage to take you beyond LEO, which again adds tremendously to the cost because you're lifting it out of the gravity well, or you can refuel once you get to LEO. Now, if you refuel, where's that fuel going to come from? Well, what I contend is what we want to do is to search for ways to use what we find in space to create capability there. Now, in the last few years, what we have found through a variety of robotic missions to the moon is that the moon actually has materials and energy resources that we need to create this capability. In terms of energy, what we found is that it's possible to stay on the moon and live in quasi-permanent sunlight. That is, effectively, you're on the moon, you're on a planetary surface, but you're in a zone where you can almost always see the sun, and therefore you can almost always generate electrical power. So that solves the problem of getting a foothold on a planet without the cost and practical difficulties of bringing a nuclear reactor to provide your power with you. You can actually do this completely with solar by going to the poles of the moon where these quasi-permanent sunlit areas are. But if that weren't good enough, we have also found that in areas proximate to these lit areas, we have large deposits of water in the form of ice at the poles of the moon. And water is an extremely useful substance in space. It can support human life. Obviously, you can drink it. You can use it to shield yourself from cosmic radiation because a water jacket is a very effective radiation shield. And you can dissociate it into its component gases, hydrogen and oxygen. You can breathe the oxygen. You can react the hydrogen and oxygen in a fuel cell to generate electricity for the very short times that you might be in solar eclipse. And the best part is the last part, and that is you can use hydrogen and oxygen as chemical rocket propellant. It's the most powerful rocket propellant we know of. That's the highest specific impulse. So in other words, the moon has the ability to become an offshore, off-planet fueling station. And what I propose and what I advocate is that by establishing a fuel production facility, a water production facility at the poles of the moon, you effectively have created, and then using reusable components that basically travel between various waypoints in the zone between Earth and Moon, you have created a completely reusable, extensible space transportation system. And if you can access the moon routinely, you can access every other point in cislunar space routinely. And so what this enables you to do is to completely change the paradigm of operations. So instead, if you wanted to build a communication station for GEO, you wouldn't have to build a very compact, very information-dense satellite and then launch it on an expendable and then have it operated for a limited lifetime. You could build in a distributed aperture, long-lived, extensible satellite system at GEO. And that would be assembled by people and robots that could travel to and from low Earth orbit to GEO, operating and building a new communications complex. So this enables entirely new capabilities that we can just barely imagine right now. We can actually have communications complexes at GEO that are the size of ISS. So what might that enable? Well, for one thing, in one fell swoop, if you were to have such a station, you would instantly render the entire terrestrial cell phone system obsolete, because anyone would be able to communicate with anyone else from any point on the observable hemisphere of the Earth with your cell phone. You'd have enough bandwidth, you'd have enough power from the station to be able to surf the web, to look at high-definition video, to talk to anyone in the world at any time. So it would completely revolutionize the communications technology network by creating entirely new capabilities that we can only dream about now. That's one example of what you could do if you were able to place this system. And as Jim said, I mean, ultimately, if the goal of human spaceflight is to learn how to live in space, how to settle space, you need to be able to learn how to use what you find there to create new capability. And going to the moon to establish this kind of capability is the first step in learning those skills.
Is there agreement that that is the goal of our, or should be the goal of our space program, to learn how to live and settle and do things in space? Do you both think that that is a unified goal, or is that up for grabs still?
I don't think it's universally agreed upon, but it's actually, I would not put it that way, and maybe I misspoke. What I meant to suggest was that I advocate undertaking this for the practical benefits of being able to create new capabilities in Cislunar, right? That's the practical benefit. That's the payback for why we should do this. The mere fact is we will learn along the way of doing that the skills that you would need to establish permanent human presence in space. So that's a side benefit. It's not the principal reason, but it's certainly something that you would get as a result of it.
Jim, what do you think about that as a goal?
Well, the human settlement of space is something that has been talked about at political levels as far as coming up with an agreement. We don't have anything in national policy that says thou shalt settle space. We don't have anything in statute that says we will settle space. There is this little piece from back in 1988 called the Space Settlement Act, but it doesn't come across as a mandate. It just says this is a good thing and it would serve the national interest. But it's very weak. It doesn't really say anything about, yes, we're going to do this. There's nothing in NASA's charter that says your job is to open up space for human settlement. It's not there. So we don't have anything documented, agreed upon. We just have a lot of rhetoric that says we're going to do this someday, but it's really vague. It doesn't say exactly what we're trying to accomplish by the movement into space or at what pace we think we should do it anything much about the whole purpose of the thing other than the usual it's our destiny type of explanation. So what we have is rhetoric that's pretty vague about human settlement of space. What we're talking about in actually developing cislunar space gives the whole thing purpose and shows that this will boost science, this will boost the economy, this will bring benefits to Earth that we would not have had otherwise by doing all of these developments. So what I would hope is that something would develop in the years to come that says, yes, now we know why we're doing this, and we know that this is the step that's going to get us there.
There's a lot of confusion in general about what we're doing in space. That is not articulated well by NASA or anybody, and if you did, let's go talk to people on the street, say Times Square, and you purposely look for intelligent people, not the buffoons they like to put on the TV shows to make fun and ridicule people. My hunch is you would get, out of 10 people, you'd get nothing but vagueness as to what our space program's purpose and benefits are to something that might be all over the board. There's so much confusion just in general that what do you say to the idea that somehow the idea of a national goal for space or a purpose or something has to be clarified for it to have the kind of importance, the kind of attention getting with the policymakers and those in Congress that cut the checks for the funding? Either you of you or both of you.
Well, it's not quite as bad as you describe it. I mean, there is a Space Act that NASA operates under, And there's a preamble to that, and in that there's seven or eight, nine different particular objectives of the establishment of the National Space Agency. And it's to, you know, improve life on Earth and increase scientific knowledge and the usual motherhood statements. Within that umbrella, it's possible to craft a program that does quite a bit. And I think that, the fact that the average person on the street can't articulate that very well isn't particularly relevant, because the average person on the street can articulate a lot of national policy that's extremely important, and yet they're certainly happy to support it if it's obvious that it brings some significant value. And the analogy I like to use is with railroads, which there's sort of a two classes of people. The vast bulk of the population fall in the first class, and that is they don't think about railroads, they don't know about railroads, and they don't care about them. But they certainly acknowledge that it's critical to our national economic way of life. And so they support the infrastructure that gives us rail travel and rail freight transport. Space is the same way. At the same time, there are people who are railroad buffs, who live, breathe, eat, and sleep this stuff. And they love this. They love railroads, and they love to talk about the arcane aspects of railroad lore. And that's very much like space. You have the vast bulk of people who don't think about it, but certainly what I want to do is I want to get space to be thought of more as a national infrastructure asset, as something that contributes to national life, but the vast bulk of the populace don't have to think about it, not because they just don't care about it. And yet they recognize that it has value, societal value, and for that reason they would support it.
Jim, any comments from you on that issue?
Yeah, I'm glad Paul brought it up that way and used the railroad analogy here, because what I've been trying to get across to a lot of people that I talk to on this subject is that ever since the beginning, we've had this thing where we try to portray space as something special. Well, of course, it is special in many ways, but we've been going with this space is special routine now for 50 years, and what we should be doing now is trying to get to the point where space is mainstream. Space is something that we do as a matter of course. Space is like other parts of the infrastructure. When you look at the transportation analogy, you see that things like maritime and roads and rail and aviation have all been recognized as essential elements of infrastructure. They are considered things that we could not do without unless we want to seriously harm our economy and other parts of society. So they are essential services. We haven't got people to the point of thinking that space constitutes essential services. Now, if you want to think about it, in a sense, you could say that it does do that because it's part of the communications infrastructure. But people don't parse out things like that. They don't really see it that way. Space is still considered by many a luxury item, a nice-to-have, a cool thing, but not an essential service the way trains and planes and cars and things are. So we have to move towards that. Now, that doesn't mean space gets boring. In fact, I think the stuff that Paul and I are talking about in developing cislunar space is pretty darn exciting. And I grew up with Apollo, so I know what exciting is in space. And I think that all of this development is exciting activity, and we all know that it leads to more exciting activity. So there's plenty there, I think, to interest people, but you don't want them necessarily thinking of it as just a special activity. You especially don't want them thinking of it that way at a time when you're having some very negative economic consequences and are thinking about austerity measures. What's the first thing you cut? That special stuff that looks like a luxury. That's what gets cut. So you have to make the case that space is an essential activity that's giving us things that we would not have had otherwise, or would not have had as good a quality or as great a quantity otherwise. So that's where we should be going with with the notions we're trying to get across in the future of space development.
You have a couple of listener email questions. So Todd in San Diego has emailed in, and he said, despite our economy being weak or maybe going to some sort of austerity plan, or even if they allow sequestration to take place, it seems to me that focusing investment in a program that the two of you are talking about serves to help repair our economy, create jobs, and get us back on track. And I'm wondering if you would agree with that. I think in rough times, you want to make sure that you allocate your funding to those programs and ventures that have the most potential to help get you out of the problems that you're in. Developing cislunar space seems to fit the bill in every capability, every capacity, and every description. Do you agree with that, or do you think it should be part of austerity or sequestration cuts? Either you or both of you.
Well, if I can jump in on that one, I think that you have a difficult balance that you have to do as a government and as a society in general. When things get tight, you don't want to cut out all of your investments in the future and just try and shore up the present or make up for problems of the past. I mean, you always have to invest the money in that area. You always have to pay pensions. You always have to fix things when they break. You always have to take care of natural disasters as they come along. But you want to have some things set aside for investment in the future. Now, to the extent that we want to invest money in a future that includes advanced space development, then the wisest thing, in my view, is to invest in new capabilities that will evolve in cislunar space. And as Paul has already mentioned, that can include things that will actually touch individuals down here, like communications, possibly the power generation proposals that have been out there, improvements in navigation. There will be also eventually, as we get into on-orbit servicing, there will be a whole new paradigm, again, in line with what Paul said, of how we operate up there, and it could become a far more efficient system that will see such a growth in capabilities that touch all our lives, weather forecasting, disaster prediction and relief. These things will touch broad swaths of people on Earth, and they will be made possible by a more efficient paradigm of operating in space. We're at a situation to go on with something that Paul said and use an Earth-based analogy, development of maritime for commerce, for science, and for other things. So we build a lot of ships, and those ships go out to do their mission, whether we're talking about small pleasure craft or big cruise ships or aircraft carriers. They all go out and they do their mission, and what if they were treated like satellites? So as soon as something breaks on board or as soon as they run out of fuel, oh, well, just we'll sink them right where they're at and build a new one. And as silly as that sounds, that's the way we behave with satellites. We sink them as soon as they break or as soon as they run out of fuel and go build new ones. And we're even talking about the same order of magnitude of investment, because from small sats on up to the most expensive national security satellites, that's a very broad range that is comparable to the types of infrastructure we spend on here on the ground. And we could not survive by throwing away everything on the ground. We have to find ways of keeping it operating out there in the field, as it were, and supplying it and doing the work locally, not everything hauled up from Earth, not every piece of technology having to be fabricated on Earth and hauled up. So there's a whole... a whole new way of behaving that needs to occur to perpetuate and improve the activities that we're doing in space, and it will be noticeable to the people on the ground once these things are up and running. Just like the railroads changed everybody's life, this development, this lunar space, will change people's lives.
Paul, Todd's question.
Yeah, I,
Yeah,
I think there is a tendency, and there always has been this tendency, that NASA's budget is very visible. And when people start talking about bringing the axe to the federal budget, NASA has a very long neck. And in part, I think that visibility and that vulnerability is related to the fact that it's been stuck in this mechanism of stunt accomplishment. The first human flag here, planted here, the first footstep there. And in fact, that mindset was enshrined in the Augustine Commission report of 2009, where they basically said that, you know, America deserves a space program where the public is presented with an exciting series of space firsts. Well, that, I think that's the wrong mindset to take. It's the wrong attitude to have. What you want from a space program is value for the money you spend. And if you are producing value, and if you're producing perceived value for the amount of money you're spending, you will tend to be thought of as essential and not discretionary. And the more valuable that you can be, the more essential you'll become. So, in effect, I guess what I'm proposing is that the kinds of things that we want to do, that creating this new capability, creating this infrastructure, that creates value. That creates value that is apparent. Now, it's a key thing that I've tried to emphasize, and I made this point in the paper that Tony Lavoie and I wrote a couple years ago, was that it's possible to design and architect a program that is scalable to the amount of resources you have. And I think that's not only desirable, I think it's absolutely critical, because in the next few years, in the next decade or two, as whatever the resolution of our national budgetary disaster is, it'll either be resolved somehow or we'll end up broke, in which case none of this will matter. If it is resolved, discretionary money is going to be in very short supply. So you've got to be able to figure out a way to accomplish your goals with the amount of money that you are given at any given time. So the way to do that is to make a program that consists of small incremental steps that act together in a cumulative manner. And I think that's possible. I think it is this particular task of cislunar transportation is amenable to that kind of approach, and that will also allow you at the same time to produce visible milestones on short timescales. And that's a main requirement of demonstrating to the Congress and to the public that you are, in fact, contributing something of value.
And if I could add on to that, if you are in the process of planning NASA's programs, then you look at the prospects for doing these planetary missions with humans. The type of involvement that you're going to have, even if it's NASA plus a whole array of international space agencies, if all of our partners around the world join up together and it becomes this giant government project, you will be getting the participation of the private sector basically as contractors. They don't have anything to gain in the foreseeable future from a program like that other than getting the government contracts to make that mission happen. So they will be contractors. Okay, that's fine, and that has its benefits, and that produces some jobs. However, if you instead take the cislunar development approach, the private sector entities that are involved in this are going to see this as, hey, maybe there's something in it for us that we can make money at in the not-too-distant future. We already have companies out there that are looking at things like in-space servicing. We already have companies that are interested in on-orbit power systems or other things that they want to make money at in the not-too-distant future. So those companies will get on board with NASA and other space agencies, not just as contractors taking the government money, but also as investors, as participants who want to stay in it for the long haul themselves, and put their own skin in the game so that they will have a long-term business benefit from this. You can get that from cislunar space development. You can't get that from planet hopping.
We have a caller on hold, but do either of you know if any of this type of incremental cislunar space planning is underway? Aside from academics and experts such as the two of you, is it happening within NASA, for example, or the groups that would help make NASA policy?
I think it's being looked at. There is the human architecture team that has been looking at missions for NASA human missions beyond LEO. One of their missions includes a significant cislunar component, and that component includes infrastructure pieces that could be useful in the kinds of things we're talking about. Now, it's not specifically oriented around the mission thrust that I'm describing, but the fact is that it will build facilities and hardware and capabilities that are relevant to what I want to do. So I would say that we're not the only ones advocating this. It's certainly not the dominant strategic direction, but it could be. And it's that's sort of why I think we're out here advocating it, is that we think it's the way to go. And if more and more people start thinking in this direction, I think we'll have more capability with time, and we'll be able to have more flexibility into how we implement it.
Okay.
And we have to make sure that NASA is and others at that level who are thinking along these lines don't just focus on these stovepipes of single programs, that they look at some type of integrated system where you have mutually reinforcing things going on in cislunar space, like, for example, as Paul mentioned, generating the fuel, an oxidizer from the moon, and that reinforces other activities that are going on, and also the building of satellite platforms and geo. It's not a stovepipe project we got a chance to start one project in the next budget cycle, and which one should it be? Well, this one at a time, piece by piece thing doesn't always come together. You have to have something where there's an integrated whole that we're all working towards, and the way to do that is to not just have it as single agency project by itself, all government funds. It's to try and bring in the international players, the private sector players, so that we have a whole system instead of just saying, okay, the next big thing we're going to do is on-orbit fuel depots. Well, okay, what other projects are going to use those? You have to look at a big picture and not just get focused on program stovepipes.
Let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Okay.
Actually, my question was, I think, largely addressed by Dr. Vetta. But my question is about what should in the development of cislunar space and lunar resources, what should be the proper relationship between government and private? And I think I heard Dr. Vetta say that there should be sort of a public-private partnership, if I understood correctly, of some nature. I was curious from Dr. Sudis what his take on this question is.
On the relative roles of government and the private sector?
In the development of lunar resources for cislunar space.
Well, to the extent that I've thought about this, I've looked at it as a completely flexible plan. I don't have any preconceived notions. I'm skeptical that it could be undertaken completely by the private sector. I have costed it and scaled it as a government program, largely on the grounds that I had assumed that we would have a NASA and it would get some certain amount of money per year, and therefore, why not spend it on something useful? So that was sort of my overwhelming assumption. But at the same time, I've left open the possibility for participation by both internationals and the private sector to whatever extent they want, and through a variety of different mechanisms. There could be from simple contracting to contributions in kind to cooperative agreements, and there's a lot of possibilities. And I don't want to preclude any possibility at this stage. At the moment, I'm just trying to get everyone on the same page and agreeing to that this is a valid and useful goal. Once we've all agreed that it is, then we can worry about how to structure it.
Yeah, as I'm looking, sort of trying to read the tea leaves as to whether, to where an Obama administration might go in the next 4 years or a Romney administration, I don't really hear either speaking about the development of disciplinary space. For Romney, I think it depends on exactly what direction. For Obama, I presume that still just continues what he's doing, which is not the development of disciplinary space. So, I mean, Dr. Vetta, do you think that there's, it's not realistic to expect commercial companies to develop this lunar space by itself without, significant financial support from NASA?
I think that the development is going to happen just the way that big infrastructure developments have always happened, and that is it's going to be a collaboration between the public and private sectors. A lot of people like to talk like there's this firewall between the two, and you can say, well, this thing here was developed by government, and this thing here was developed by private sector, and usually in the case of the types of discussions we're usually having, say, oh, look, the railroads were developed privately, the aviation industry was developed privately, and that's why it's so separate and distinct from the government and more successful and on and on. Well, don't believe it for a minute, because all of these things required a cooperation between the two sectors. In the case of the railroads, for example, and you've probably heard this story before, the railroads were given huge amounts of land by the government. And we're not talking about just a little strip wide enough to put a track. We're talking about a mile or so on either side of that. So if you add it all up, the amount of land that the government gave to the private sector for the railroads in the 19th century is adds up to about the size of Texas. So and they also gave them free surveying data for all of this land, which is not inconsequential in itself. So that was a collaboration. Of course, we know all of the help that the government gave to the aviation industry in research on aircraft design, in being an early anchor tenant with the U.S. Mail. It's always, for big infrastructure and especially with advancing technology, it's always a collaboration between public and private sectors. They each have to define their role. It's not always a smooth relationship, but it is an essential relationship. I don't think either side is capable of taking this as far as it should go in any reasonable time frame alone. It has to be worked together. Countless examples of how that's been true through history. I don't think that's going to change as we move into space. The government is really good at helping industry buy down the risk. So if you have a government agency, if you have people like the folks over at Goddard Space Flight Center who have been working on satellite servicing techniques, and they buy down the risk on that, and they are able to pass along that information, that experience to the private sector and say, hey, guys, run with it. That's where you're going to see a really good synergy that will make these things happen. So government can buy down the risk, but government has to be prepared to hand it off when it's ready for operations. That's one of the things that NASA has not been so good at so far. Develop something to the point where it's operational, hand it off to a real operator. So we still have things to learn, but it's essential that both sectors are there in a partnership.
But I think we're getting there with low Earth orbit, at least in terms of NASA sort of helping companies and then handing off to them that function, and then letting that function, and then NASA can focus on other things. But I just wanted to speak to something that was mentioned before. I agree with you, Dr. Spudis, about it's not the purpose of government to be, doing things to excite the public. And yet, at the same time, I believe that this lunar development, in particular the lunar surface development, it isn't going to lack for excitement at all. I think about the, you know, imagine a Robonaut 2 landing on the surface and just how much attention that that would get. I think the first woman landing on the moon was just, you know, watched by 5 billion people, and a billion girls, has all sorts of incredible impact. And the fact that this is sustainable, it is, you know, providing life support, you know, as sort of a side benefit of propellant production, as well as being able to live under roofs, regolith. I mean, people can live on the moon for a rather extended period of time, and I think people would understand that this is not just capability, it's also a step towards development of space. So I think that this is actually a very exciting approach, in my opinion.
Is that it, Doug?
Well, I agree. Okay. I agree. And, you and I are excited by it. My only point is the vast bulk of the public is not. And it's the simple fact is if you look at public opinion for the value of space for the last 50 years, it always levels out at about 50-50. And the support is a mile wide and an inch deep. People think, yeah, it's a good idea, and they don't really mind it so much because there's not too much spin on it and not too many people get killed doing it. But they aren't as rabidly excited and jazzed by it like we are. And I just recognize that. I recognize that most people aren't as excited about space as I am, and that's fine. NASA has always seen this as a problem. They've consistently looked for something that they thought would get the public excited. And my contention is that's the wrong way to look at it. Public apathy is your ally. If people are not terribly preoccupied with it and think about it a lot and worry about what you're doing, then you're free to do the right thing, even if it's not the most exciting thing in the world. And if I happen to think it's exciting to go to the moon, most people don't, and that's fine. But my point is that all of us benefit by doing it, and that's the selling point. The selling point is returning value for expenditure. It's not returning excitement for expenditure.
Yeah, and I think that the International Space Station, I don't think is generally considered to be the most exciting thing, and yet budgets were sustained across administrations to develop that capability. So I think that sort of gives an example that, you know, we don't have to have the excuse of excitement to justify space development. I think it has its own justification, and the excitement comes along the way, I think, but it's not essential. That's my feeling.
Okay. Doug, anything else, or is that it?
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, that does free the line, 1-866-687-7223. Do we have the technology in place today to actually begin on this, or is the initial first couple of steps the need for technology development, either of you?
Well, in terms of actually beginning to develop CisLunar, we have everything we need right now. There are unknowns, but they are unknowns in terms of tactical implementation, not in terms of technology, missing technology. So, for example, if you accepted the architecture that we came up with, which was designed to be this scalable incremental architecture, the first step is to go and prospect and survey the ice deposits at the poles of the moon on the ground so that you'll know what you're dealing with. You know what your feedstock is, you'll know how to handle it, you'll know how to process it, and then do a demonstration that you can do that in the end. All of that can be done right now with hardware and technology that we have in hand. As you move forward in that kind of a program, there will be new technological challenges that you'll have to address and answer. But my contention is that you'll get that as the need arises. If you have a need to do X, you will develop the technical means to do so. And so, in my view, you get technology by trying to do something, not just by going into the shop and starting to build widgets.
So we could start right now. There's nothing preventing us now technologically from starting on this kind of a program.
I don't think there is.
You know, we have to commit to demonstrations, pilot projects. I mean, that's where we're lacking right now is, like Paul says, the technology's there, but we have to have the pilot projects to prove out the concept in the actual environment where they're going to have to operate. That's the next step, really.
You have this question from Larry in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, a few minutes ago you were talking about fuel propellant in orbit. Are you talking about fuel coming from the moon, depots being refueled by lifting the fuel from Earth in our gravity well, or both?
Well, yeah. I'm talking about mostly the fuel coming from the moon. Initially, an Earth orbital depot will probably be supplied from Earth because you won't have the facilities on the moon to deliver propellant. But the whole point of the architecture I was advocating is to build that facility. So initially, the fuel comes from the Earth in depots for use that orbit the Earth and they're in low lunar orbit. But ultimately, both of those facilities are supplied with fuel manufactured on the moon.
And you're talking not in LEO, but in low lunar orbit.
I'm talking both.
Okay.
The architecture that Tony Lavoie and I wrote, we have a depot in low Earth orbit and a depot in low lunar orbit.
Okay.
That's one implementation. I mean, there's a lot of variations you could do on that. That happens to be the direction we took.
Okay, Jim, what were you going to say?
At some point, you might pick other locations, Lagrange points, geo orbit. Depends on where your activity takes you. We don't need to assume that all things are going to be done in LEO. So I would agree with the description that Paul just gave there, that initially you got to haul things up from the Earth, but the intent is that's only temporary until you build the facilities you need to do it better, so that as much as possible of the resources comes from off-planet.
We've got an email from Sandra in Seattle, and she said, several years ago, Jeff Grayson of X-Corps delivered a speech at an NSS-ISDC meeting that went viral on the Internet, at least within the space enthusiast community, claiming that space settlement was the only purpose, the only mission, the only reason we do anything in space, particularly human spaceflight, and his talk was totally focused on human settlement. So does that include what you're talking about? Is that a dangerously narrow focus? I'm a little bit confused. Can you have space settlement as the ultimate goal and then cislunar as a subset or an incremental step? Or is cislunar the ultimate goal and settlement the subset?
I'm familiar with the speech that's referred to there by Jeff Grayson, and in fact I addressed that briefly in my book. Jeff is claiming that we've already decided on a purpose for all of this. We've already decided on a goal, and it is space settlement. Well, No, we haven't, not in any official sense. Maybe he was talking to an audience of all space advocates at that conference.
Right.
And certainly among that group, that's probably true. But as far as anything official in either the government or either in the societal expectations generally, no, space settlement is not a done deal. And in fact, the way he described it to me sounded like skipping steps. He said, well, we're going to do this kind of bootstrap thing where we're going to go to this location and pick up all we need to go to the next location and the next location. Well, that's just another way of describing the destination-driven thing that does not have a clear purpose. And some people may describe it, and as I mentioned in the book, that sounds like the ultimate self-licking ice cream cone. Why do we go into space? We go into space so we can go further into space. No, this is not going to fly. We have to have more purpose. We have to have something that brings value, and especially things that bring benefits back to Earth, so everybody back home continues to be supportive. And it has an economic driver, so you can afford to do the next thing. So settlement as a standalone thing is to me not the right way to go, not the right way to sell this.
Paul, any comments?
I have a different take on that. I know Jeff's talk. I know what he said. I listened to it. I think he was speaking from a more philosophical point of view. And the philosophical question is this. Why would you go to the expense and trouble and danger of sending people into what is fundamentally a hostile environment? If you think about it, if your goal is to obtain scientific data, you can do that robotically. If your goal is to set up a communications relay, you don't need people for that. If you want to measure plasmas or magnetic fields or look at the stars, all that can be done without people. Why do you want to send people there? And I think that he has considered this from a philosophical point of view. And from that point of view, the real motivation of becoming a multi-planet species is species survival. You send people to settle space because you don't want all of humanity's eggs in one basket. Because we know that the story of life on Earth is the story of extinction. It's basically that every species that has ever existed on the Earth, with very, very few exceptions, is now extinct. And it's quite likely that Homo sapiens will be one of those species. So if you have settlements and reservoirs of human culture on multiple worlds, there's a much better chance that humanity, as both as a species and as a cultural transmission agent, is much more likely to survive. So that's sort of an ultimate rationale. It's not a rationale for NASA. It's not a NASA mission statement. It's not even really a justification for a space program. What it is a philosophical statement as to the value of human spaceflight. Now, what is the relation of cislunar development to that? Cislunar development is a step along a long path that gradually leads to us becoming a multi-planet species. The things that you will do in establishing a presence in cislunar, establishing a permanent presence on the moon, learning to use the resources and energy that you find there, those are the skills that humanity needs to master if they are ever to do this. If you acquire those skills and you decide not to do this, or you don't care about doing this, that's perfectly fine. You still have value return because you have the cislunar infrastructure that gives you all the benefits I described earlier. At the same time, the stuff that you're doing, the kinds of activities you're undertaking, the research you're doing, the knowledge that you're gaining is applicable and relevant to the future goal of settlement of space if and when we decide that becomes necessary. Now, I think that's where Jeff was coming from, and I think that this program entirely meshes with that sort of a long-range societal vision.
Is that vision productive or counterproductive in general for our national civil space program? I'm not talking about the space enthusiasts, but in general, is that helpful or neutral or detrimental?
Well, you can look at it either way. You can say it's a detriment because it increases the giggle factor too much. And as an example of that, you can look at what happened at last year's Republican primary, where Newt Gingrich made a comment about colonies on the moon, and of course Romney took that and made a lot of political hay out of it. That's always a problem. Anytime you outline a visionary statement or some aspiration that's multi-generational, you're going to be subject to being ridiculed. At the same time, it for the true believers, it gives them something to believe in that's on a time scale longer than their lifetime, that what they're working on and what they've devoted their life to actually has long-term value for humanity. And in that sense, I think it does have value.
Of course, the other thing that the other aspect of the survival question, and I agree with what Paul said as far as it goes, but there's always that opportunity cost of which part of survival do you invest in? Is it placing human colonies on other celestial bodies, or what about investing in something that works towards the ability to do deflection of asteroids that are aiming at us, or taking better care, better stewardship of the Earth so that we don't mess up the ecosystem using space technology to provide those observations?
There are societal disasters that you cannot mitigate, like supervolcanoes. So, right. I mean, it is possible that we could become extinct strictly through a fluke of nature, and the only solution to that I'm aware of is to have multiple reservoirs of human culture.
that, of course, that's, as you indicated, that's going to be too far of a reach for a lot of people. Because,
but I'm not using it as justification.
Yeah.
I'm using it as sort of a long-term strategic horizon.
Of course, we could become extinct.
And as you correctly point out, the things that we do to develop this lunar space now feed into the ability to do that stuff later.
Of course, we could.
Right. If we don't develop this lunar space now, we won't learn the things that we need to carry that out at a later time.
Of course, we could.
Exactly.
We could become extinct because of our own behavior toward each other. And you know, I guess that's realistic as well. I don't know that that eventuality is really part of what we're talking about, but I guess it's out there.
Well, we've been trying to exterminate each other, I think, pretty much for the duration of the human race, and we haven't succeeded yet.
Boy, what happened there to the sound? I don't know what happened to our audio. Jim, do you have any comment on my crazy comment?
I was just going to say that could go down a depressing track that we don't need to do in this program. Let's be more uplifting.
Maybe going on cislunar and having the international community and other components involved is uplifting in itself and helping to prevent the kind of behavior I sort of indicated. Gentlemen, we're at the break point for our program. Actually, we're a little past it. So we are going to take a 3-minute break, everybody. We'll be back with Jim and Paul. Don't go anyplace. And we do answer the phone if you call in during the break. It is 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our special classroom production today. We're talking cislunar space with Dr. Jim Vetta, Dr. Paul Spuda, your comments, calls, and questions, and I am hosting the program. And we'll start off, gentlemen, with an email that I got from Doug, who called in a little while ago. And again, listeners, by the way, the toll-free number, if you do want to call, 1-866-687-7223. I do realize it's a Friday morning show. Many of you are at work. But for those of you who can get to a phone, dial away. This is what Doug said. To what extent do both of you think that the Google Lunar XPRIZE contestants will be able to conduct lunar prospecting missions? For example, Astrobotic just revealed a lunar ice prospector. Will missions on that scale be sufficient to characterize icy regolith? And it's not really pertinent to our discussion, but I'll go ahead and ask it. Any of your thoughts on Google Lunar X Prize?
Yeah, I certainly the Astrobotic rover could contribute some key information. and yes, it would be valuable. In part, it depends on how they design that mission and what instruments it carries and where it goes. But it's in any event, even in the best possible case, it's going to be insufficient. What we really need is a detailed and extensive reconnaissance of both poles to characterize where the best deposits are for ice mining. So it's a step forward. It's possibly will yield some critical new insights, but it's not going to be all we need. We're going to need more information than what a single rover mission could provide.
Jim, any comments from you on this?
Well, I have been closely tracking the specific goals or designs of the Google Lunar XPRIZE teams, so I can't really comment on anything with precision with what they're doing. But it seems to me that their biggest problems are going to be in the attempt to just safely get there, to find somebody who will provide the launch for them, successfully get them to the moon and successfully land. That in itself will be a great achievement, especially if they can actually do it by the XPRIZE goal of, I believe it's 2015. So I do have some skepticism that it can be all pulled together by then, because these projects, as we've seen happen even with the top professionals here, they are more difficult than they seem at the beginning when you first embark on putting them together. They're going to find the same type of problems, and best of luck to all of them. But it's a tough nut to crack, and I'm not sure if 2015 is giving them enough time to really work through all the bugs and get a successful mission going.
Just a comment for all of you who are big believers and supporters of Google Lunar XPRIZE. If you were to go back and listen to the shows with Bob Richards, Tim Pickens, and others who are involved in this thing, number one, that they have already missed their deadlines for getting a launch vehicle that would allow them to go to the moon in time to be a winner for the prize. And there's only one team that has actually confirmed a ride on a rocket, and it's a non-American, it's a foreign team. I forget where it's coming. There are no other launch vehicle contracts that have been cut, purchases, no deposits, nothing. So unless Google Lunar XPRIZE changes the dates for winning, they're already out of the question for winning, because the lead times to get a ride are just too huge. And flying as secondary payloads has probably taken a big step back, given what happened to Orbcomm on the recent Falcon 9 launch, with the primary going to the ISS, because primary takes precedence and secondary is at risk, and they will save primary and not try to save secondary when choice comes to pull. But you ought to go back through the archives and listen to what Bob Richards has said about this, as well as Tim Pickens, and also Tim talked about what was going on at Google Lunar XPRIZE. I think being skeptical at this point is an understatement, and maybe they'll pull it together and extend the dates. I don't know. That's far afield from our discussion today. But just use the guest search tool for Robert Richards or Bob Richards and Tim Pickens and pull up those programs and hear what the guys doing it are actually saying about these issues. And so that brings us back to our discussion going forward. Do any of you have any information at all as to whether cislunar development is being heard to the point where, after the campaign is over with and we know who's actually won, that it can be implemented and brought into our official space policy, or we're not at that point yet in official dumb? Is it, just sort of in the theoretical concept stage? Does anyone have any?
I think it's a bit early for that, because it doesn't have this growing thrust behind it that is going to bring it into primacy once we get past the next month or so. So I think that's something that still has to bubble up over a considerable amount of time. It's not going to be something that we're going to say will be automatically on the agenda. I mean, it could surprise me and people could start noticing, but my suspicion is that we're not going to see any evidence of this getting into the mainstream anytime soon.
Yeah, I probably pretty much agree with that, except to the extent that some of what NASA's doing now in terms of looking at missions beyond LEO is relevant to what we want to do. So it's not totally off the radar, but it's certainly as a coherent, integrated strategic direction, it has not manifested itself yet.
This is Elaine in Albany, New York. David, I'm at work. I can listen, but I can't use the phone. Please ask your guest if there are any other national space agencies, such as ESA, Russia, or China, for example, that are considering making cislunar space development a priority of their space program, thus enabling them to leap over in advancements and technology and development over the United States. Does anyone know anything about that?
It's sort of a new idea in the sense. In the sense we're talking about, you know, we've sort of taken what a lot of people have talked about for a long time and put it together with a slightly different twist on it. However, I will say this, 2 months from now in Paris in December, there will be the very first European meeting on development of space and cislunar space is a part of that. I'm on the organizing committee for that meeting and I will be there for that. And for the first time, ESA and other international partners will come to this meeting and discuss the various aspects of building a cislunar transportation system. So it is starting to percolate and starting to attract some interest. It's also been brought before the International Lunar Working Group. The Canadians in particular have championed this idea because they really like the idea of robotic mining. They do that in Canada. They think that has applications on the moon, and Canada has a long tradition of experience in space robotics. So I would say that yes, there are people who are starting to become aware of the possibilities. It hasn't advanced very far, but I have a very good feeling about future interest in this direction.
Jim, anything on that for you?
Yeah, if I was to pick another country that at least philosophically, if not programmatically, has given this a lot of thought, it would be Japan. They've certainly been very interested in lunar development for a long time. So that's the only one I would single out. The other thing I mentioned is the something that I dealt with in my book a little bit was the Global Exploration Roadmap. The process has been started by a coalition of world space agencies to look at where we should be going in the future. And they say some really good things that you have not typically seen in this type of report. They did their first iteration of their roadmap last September, and they intend to keep updating this on a roughly annual basis. So they really came out with some good, strong statements about developing capabilities and infrastructure for off-Earth operations and supporting commercial entities and creating new markets and pursuing planetary defense and orbital debris management. And these were all in their goals. And I'm thinking, hey, great, this is really a good recognition of where we should be going that goes beyond taking humans to space and sending probes out to the outer planets. So they really seem to get the idea of building infrastructure, bringing in commercial, all that kind of good stuff that plays very well in the notion of cislunar space development. However, if you go on to read the rest of the report, you see that when they lay out their alternatives, they completely miss the notion of cislunar development, and both of the recommended alternatives that they have are ways to get to Mars. Go to Mars by stopping at an asteroid first, or go to Mars by stopping at the moon first. So it gets back to the destination-driven thing. And I was a little disappointed to see them kind of backtrack in that way and not have a third alternative that says develop cislunar space. So there's better conversation going on out there about these things, but there's still it still has not taken hold the way we would like it to.
For people interested in this, are there ways they can play a role in it? And Paul, what is the name of that conference in Paris that you're talking about?
I'll look it up for you. I don't have it handy at the moment.
Is it available for anyone to attend, or is it a...
Yes, it is open to anyone. I will send you the link to it. It has a web page, and it occurs, it's in Paris on the 17th, 18th, and 19th of December, I believe.
Okay. Interesting. This is Joe, and Joe is in Dallas, Texas. And Joe says, does any of our capability with COTS and then commercial crew and the rockets that are being developed, are they needed to be a success to get this program underway? For example, do we need Falcon 9? Do we need Falcon Heavy? Can we do this with the existing EELVs? Do we need SLS to continue to be funded? Anyone want to answer that?
Oh, boy, that's a real batch of interesting questions there. I guess what I would have to say is that you look at your basic needs, and you do need a range of launch vehicles that can take the small, medium, large payloads up there. We have not designed the architecture yet to determine exactly what we need for what mission to do this. Now, it's always helpful if you have a heavy lifter out there, so that you can be less constrained by the weight and configuration of the payloads that you want to put up. So say you want to put up some pilot project for solar power generation and geo, it helps to have a heavy lifter so that whatever modules you put up there don't have to be shrunk down to an unreasonably small size. But having said that, the question becomes, which is the right launcher that you're going to be able to afford to use repeatedly for such missions? The developments we've seen in rocketry in recent years, when you look at how they have been directed to the questions of cost, schedule, and performance, the three big things that everybody has to think about in the launch game, you find that here and around the world, they've done pretty well in improving performance, heavier lift, be more accurate placement of the payload and its where it's supposed to be on orbit, more reliable for its launch performance. That's all great. Performance has shown some nice incremental improvements over the years. Cost and schedule, on the other hand, have been more elusive. That's putting it kindly. The costs, as in per pound to orbit, or the cost per launch of a vehicle, the ability to keep on a schedule so that things get up there when you want them to, or to be flexible in your schedule so that you can move things around if necessary to different launch dates, that has still been very, very difficult. So we have something like one of the things mentioned was the EELVs. Okay. Nice rockets. They've been performing very well. They've had a couple of minor glitches early on, but they've had a steady stream of literally dozens of successful launches for their government payloads. As far as a mission assurance type of perspective, they've done great. But as far as cost, They're too expensive even to put on the commercial market now. They just can't meet the expectations of what the market is willing to spend. And as far as schedule, they are way behind the schedule that that the U.S. government had planned a few years ago. As far as the pace of launches, far behind what that was anticipated to be. So performance is gradually getting better. But cost and schedule, we have really not seen any improvements in a long time. And my own question is, what is there to indicate that SLS will be able to beat that? Will SLS be any better at cost and schedule? And from the evidence they've seen so far, there's no reason to think that it will. It may be a extremely good performing rocket. It may be the best thing that's ever come out in that class of launch vehicle as far as performance. But cost and schedule still going to be a big problem, even in a few years down the road when that becomes operational.
Paul, do you have anything on that?
Well, you can approach the cislunar development from a lot of different perspectives, and I think that the actual implementation, which vehicles you use, what kind of architecture you design, is less important than the commitment to do it. What I'm trying to do is to sort of raise consciousness as to the value of doing this. That if you were to do this, you would get X, Y, and Z as benefits. And exactly how you go about implementing it, I think, is of lesser importance. The reason that I did the paper with Tony, with our architecture, we made choices. We said we're going to use this kind of, we need this kind of payload capacity, we need these many flights, we need depots here, we need this facility there. But that was only to demonstrate that it's technically possible and to lay out a sample architecture so that you could cost it and get a rough idea of what kind of level of effort you need. And I think we did that, and I think our estimates are reasonably good. So as to exactly how we do it, if someone wants to come up with a better way, with a cheaper rocket, with a more optimum series of missions, that's fine with me. I'm not worried about the details. I'm actually rather flexible about that at the moment. I think it's more important to recognize that this goal of developing a cislunar transportation system is a good objective. It's a reachable one. It's the one that creates the most options and the most capabilities for whatever future direction you want to go in. So what I'm trying to do and what I'm focusing on is trying to get people to agree to that proposition. And if that's agreed to, then we can worry about the details of how to implement it.
Here's an email from both of you from Tim in St. Louis. And he says, David, I am at work, can't use the phone. Also, I hope you read my note on the show. I know you might be mad because we're beating the hell out of the Giants in the playoffs, but that shouldn't have anything to do with your reading this note. So, Tim, I'm bigger than that. So,
and you've just proven it.
Yeah, your Cardinals can go suck, but maybe the Giants will change that tonight. We will see. But here is Tim's question. You may think this is unrelated, but bear with me. I'm going to connect the dots. David recently did a sequestration program with Dr. Fuller from the George Mason University. Some of the collateral damage that Dr. Fuller talked about was not just the reductions in federal spending in the sequestration bill, but the impact on the primes and then the multiplier effect into private businesses that support the primes and those smaller businesses that even have the government as a customer that are going to be impacted by this. Therefore, there is a clear chain that you can follow to see how business benefits with government spending in aerospace and DOD spending activities. Now let me connect the dots to what you're talking about today. It seems to me if cislunar offers the kind of economic development and benefits to humanity and society, and specifically to the economies of the United States for participating in it, the most articulate, advocative, I don't think that's a real word, Tim, but anyway, community that should get behind something like this is the business community and the small business community, because after all, they will be the ones supporting the primes and making the contracts, since the government doesn't own the businesses and doesn't contract with itself. So my question is, have either of you thought of taking this concept into the business community, the small business community across America, and to those parties that will actually benefit firsthand by the increased business and profit potential opportunities afforded them were we to actually seriously undertake cislunar economic development?
Who do you want to go first on this?
Jim, will you want to go first?
I guess what I would acknowledge is that it's true that you really have to look all the way down the chain for the ramifications of what we're about to do or what's going to be inflicted upon us or whatever, because in this issue of the sequestration or any other belt tightening that we have, like the issue we've been dealing with for years in export control, the real harm that could come from things like this is down in that second, third, fourth tier of contractors, because the big guys, the primes that are out there, they don't like it when this stuff happens. They feel the pain too, but they're going to just muscle their way through it and get over it, and they'll survive, and they'll just make a little less profit that year or whatever, but they'll be okay in the long run. Whereas when you go down the supply chain further, this is an existential threat for a lot of them. So yes, they have a very big stake in what goes on here. The trick is, of course, trying to demonstrate to them, first of all, after you find all of the relevant people, because we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of companies, to demonstrate to them that they will get a piece of the action in what we're talking about. And since we don't have the architecture and we don't have the go-ahead to implement it yet, it's a bit of a hard sell to go to these companies and say, you know, those widgets that you've been making for this or that defense or NASA project, well, now we've got a whole new market for you, and it's right around the bend. It's difficult to make that case at this point, and it's a fragmented community that you'd be working with. So yes, that's a community that should be involved in this, but it's hard to touch them in the right ways to get them involved.
Paul, do you share those thoughts? Have something different?
Well, let me take this in sort of steps. First of all, I talk to anyone who wants to listen to me. So I have talked to aerospace companies. I've talked to business. I've talked to academia. I've talked to government. I've talked to community groups, the state groups, and the national groups. So I will talk to anyone about this idea who wants to listen. I am more than happy to do that. So it's not a problem of communicating. Frankly, I don't think sequestration will happen. I think people are playing chicken with that right now. I think that something will be worked out. No matter who wins the election, it's not in anyone's interest for this to actually happen. So it will be avoided, and possibly at the last minute. So it'll be very dramatic, but it'll be avoided at the last minute. But as to your fundamental question is that given that small business and aerospace business and the business community is one of the principal beneficiaries of this kind of initiative, can we look to them to support it and actually implement it? And I think not, for the simple reason that if you present it to them, their immediate thought is going to be that they will see that this has benefits for them in a variety of ways, but that it's NASA's job, or at a minimum, it's the government's job to undertake this. That's going to be their first reaction. And I think fundamentally that's the basic flaw in the idea that the private sector can do this by themselves. That fundamentally, this is a problem in systems engineering and integration. And while any given company may produce the best X in the world, the best rocket engine, the best life support system, the best propulsion tankage, whatever you want, whatever piece you need to do this, they may be able to produce the best in the world. There are very few corporate entities that can integrate all these pieces in an end-to-end system and then fly it and demonstrate it and validate it. And fundamentally, that's why we have a NASA. That's what we look to NASA to do. We want government to do those things that are difficult and risky and perhaps have a payoff, but a long-term payoff, not a near-term payoff. And going to the moon and using its resources is something that should be doable in principle, but because it's never been done, it needs to be demonstrated that it can be done. So in that sense, they're not going to get on board until they see that NASA is on board, or that federal government has an interest in this. And I'll close with one more thought on this as to the role of government versus the private sector. There is another reason why I think you want government to do this, and that is to establish the principle that we can go to an extraterrestrial body, extract usable product from it, and then retain the right to use and vend and expend that product in any way we see fit. Now, that seems like a truism, and a lot of people seem to think that, well, I can go up there and I can stake my mining claim on the moon and I can mine my unobtainium and I can sell it on the market and I can become a billionaire. It's not clear that you can do that. And when anything is not clear in a legal sense, you're really asking for it. You're asking for trouble. I mean, eventually someone will haul you into court and sue you for everything you have. And even if you're in the right, and even if you ultimately prevail, this will cost you time, it will cost you effort, it will cost you money. One of the reasons you want government to do this is to establish the principle that we can do this, that we have a right to do this, that there is no fundamental violation of human rights or however you want to look at it in doing this kind of thing. In other words, we use the government to establish the legal and economic political paradigm of a free market and democratic pluralism in space. And I think that's why it's important that the United States be involved in this at some very fundamental level. Because if we're not, if everyone who's on the frontier, whether it's corporate or some kind of authoritarian political system, if we're not there, there is no guarantee that individual property rights and the rule of law and contract enforcement and respect for intellectual property and copyright, it's not clear that any of that will be recognized. And so I think that is, of all things, that's one of the important reasons why the government should be involved in this. So there's certainly a role for the private sector. There's a role for the internationals. I think that there is a clear and absolute requirement for our own government to be involved in this.
Okay, so your next email question, again, listeners, there's still time if you want to call in, 1-866-687-7223. Linda's in Tempe, Arizona, and says, gentlemen, can you tell me if at anywhere in your plan, especially in the early stages of implementing cislunar development, if you find out that some of your research and assumptions were wrong, is there room to restart, rethink, stop? Or are you just plowing ahead or canceling? For example, there seems to be new research indicating, and Paul, this is what you and I were talking about before the show, there seems to be new research indicating that there may not be very much water at the moon. It may have come from wind and other theories, and in fact, maybe going to NEOs would be a better source if water is an essential product. What happens if you do your research and you find out these newer theories are correct?
Well, first of all, it is not correct that the new paper that came out last week says there's less water on the moon. All that paper said was that there is a mechanism to create OH molecules from the solar wind interacting with lunar dust. And that's hardly a new insight. We've known about that for some time. What this work documented was that a lot of the hydroxyl molecules in the dust collected by Apollo are solar wind rather than cometary deposition. That says nothing about the amount of ice near the poles of the moon. It says nothing about the source of that ice, and it says nothing about the quantities of it. But to answer the question directly, we specifically, in the architecture we devise, we specifically make the requirement to prospect both North and South Poles to verify how much ice is there, what its physical state is, how accessible it is, what its geotechnical properties are, and to demonstrate from an end-to-end basis the retrieval of ice-laden regolith, the extraction of water, and the storage of water. So we demonstrate all that at a small scale, at the bench scale, before we ever send the first piece of equipment. So after the first two rover missions, if we suddenly find that the moon is bone dry, that all of this abundant data from multiple instruments over several years carried by different missions and different countries' spacecraft that are all telling us that there are tons of water, billions of tons of water at the poles, is all wrong. It's all been an illusion. We've just imagined it. we will know that after our first two missions, and then you can cancel the program and go do something else. So in other words, you craft a program that incrementally gives you the knowledge you need to develop and set up a system that will produce water. And you don't depend on what we know now, because frankly, we don't know enough now. And I readily admit that. I readily admit I don't know how much is there. I don't know how it varies laterally and vertically. I don't know what its physical state is. But you have to ascertain that, and the way you do that is to fly these robotic missions first.
Yeah, that's what demonstrations and pilot projects are all about. You got to find out whether what you think will work actually will work, and then you change to adapt to what you find out. If you go to the moon and say, okay, we know that element X is on the moon and we want to go mine it, and we think that this particular design of instrumentation will do the job, and then you get to the moon and you find out, oh man, this just isn't working. Or it works, but it's incredibly inefficient. Then you go back to the drawing board. That's what this part of the process is all about. That's why I emphasized demonstration projects before, and that's why, as Paul indicated, you got to have government involvement to help buy down the risk on these things. You do this because this is a long-term venture that may not have payoff for a while, may have some technical setbacks that require investment beyond what any one company can do. This is the imperative for those demonstration projects that I identified earlier as the next step.
If water were not there in sufficient quantities, wouldn't cislunar development still be what you want to pursue, because it's so much closer and so much easier to learn how to live and do things in space and build and mine and whatever on the moon, that you'd still want to make that a focal point? Or is the water absolutely essential to this entire concept?
It's not essential. It's definitely an enabling asset. And just to put some perspective on this, there was a study at the Colorado School of Mines about a decade ago, and the question they looked at was how concentrated would the water have to be to make the production of propellant from lunar ice economically viable? And the number they came up with was about 1 weight percent. Now, the L-Cross impactor at a site that I don't actually find particularly attractive, but that they hit, they found between 5 to 10 weight percent water. So that's a factor of between 10 and 5 and 10 times higher than what the Colorado School of Mines studied said would be needed. So I really don't think that it's likely that we'll find that there's not enough there. I suspect the problems are going to be different. It's not going to be involved in us finding that the moon is drier than we thought. It's going to involve problems in the extraction and handling of the material that I suspect we don't fully appreciate right now. I my suspicion is that there are complexities in that we have not yet anticipated. And, you know, it doesn't mean we can't try. We're trying to understand what that involves. But until you actually do it, you're not going to know. So, yes, I do anticipate there will be problems. No, I don't think they're going to be showstoppers. But David, your point is, even if it's completely unfeasible for whatever reason it turns out to be, you're right. It still makes sense to develop and test beyond LEO systems in cislunar, because that's the next zone outward, and it's also the zone where all of our satellite assets are.
Yeah, it's not all about the water. It's about everything that we want to do in space. And you test it and you prove it out here in our backyard, whether it's radiation protection for humans or use of material resources or use of energy resources that we find out there. Cislunar space is everything in cislunar space is within a 3 to 4 day ride, and it's within one light second of communication. You don't have that true anywhere else. If you talk about going to Mars, at its closest point, Mars is 145 times further away than the moon. Really, you have to prove out these things close to home and then decide when you're ready to go beyond that. So cislunar plays into whatever we do, whether the water thing works or not.
Bob in Boston, since cislunar development is definitely a long-term, long-haul development project, the ISS is supposed to expire around 2020, although maybe they'll extend it a few years. How crucial is having the ISS remain in orbit to cislunar development? Either of you?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I think that's going to depend on, first of all, will they extend it to 2028 as they're contemplating now? Secondly, what program of productive research will they be doing? And perhaps most importantly, what other experiment facilities will be put up into orbit by other governments or by the private sector that will do research similar to the space station? It may not be the only game in town once we get past 2020.
Yeah, and I think the ISS has a lot of potential value to this. I mean, a lot of the things you want to learn how to do in cislunar, we've already learned from working on the ISS, like building big distributed systems in space. But there are other things that are also directly relevant, things like cryogenic fuel production in space or cracking water, which they could do on ISS, experimenting with that, experimenting with fuel transfer, experimenting with the kinds of things we'd want to do if you developed a cislunar space infrastructure. So I place the ISS as a research asset in cislunar development, and we'll use it if it's available, and if it is, they turn out to, if they decide not to extend its life and deorbit it, then we will develop whatever other assets we might need in LEO to take its place.
Chris in Indianapolis says, David, I'm at work. You know the drill. There is a lot of talk about developing a lunar space elevator. Recently, the guys were highly successful on Kickstarter, raising more than $100,000 to do research studies. They have recently released publicity statements saying that they hope to be operating or building a lunar space elevator by 2020. Assume for a minute that that's real. I know that's a big assumption. But is something like a lunar space elevator an enabler for cislunar space, or do you just discount it because it's so far out there?
It could be. It's certainly something you want to look at in the long term. I am skeptical that it could be done on a decade-like time scale, but in the long run, it may be something that we want to do to create a cislunar infrastructure. But I fundamentally think that you want to stick with flight systems, at least for the near term, simply because they're proven. We know we can go to the moon and land on it. We know we can take off from the moon and come back to the Earth. There's no reason not to continue that until we have that system established. And I don't want to depend on something that's never been done yet.
Jim, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I would concur with that exactly. Great idea if it works, but don't sit around waiting for it before you start doing other things. You have to push ahead, and if that comes along, very helpful. But if it doesn't, you don't want to waste time waiting for it. So I agree with Paul on that.
So you're not planning it as being there into any systems architecture, but if it shows up, it would be definitely probably beneficial. Fair way of saying.
Yeah, we've got proven systems that, as Paul indicated, we can move ahead with stuff that we have and or know how to build already. So it's not necessary for us to proceed.
Doug has sent in a couple of more email questions. Perhaps he'll call them in. Not sure. Number one, are there any cislunar transportation issues that might still be a showstopper? For example, might fuel depots be too difficult to get working? Is the storage and transfer of liquid hydrogen too difficult? Might aerobraking be too difficult to count on?
Well, I have my questions about the on-orbit fuel depot is how are you going to implement this in a way that is can be practically sustained? The study that NASA did internally a year or so ago looked at just using a low Earth orbit fuel storage facility for NASA missions to the moon and beyond. To me, that doesn't seem very practical, because how often is it going to get used? I mean, if you have a mission launching once a year, or maybe once every 2 years, are you really going to maintain a facility that has to have its own propulsion system, it has to have thermal shielding, it has to have the ability to be refueled routinely, especially if you got cryogenics there that are boiling off? Wow, it sounds like this is a logistical and financial disaster waiting to happen, unless it's something that's going to be used very routinely by the whole world. Like, it becomes the spacefaring world's gas station. You have standardized fixtures here so that the U.S. and the Russians and the Japanese and ESA and everybody who wants to use this thing can go up there and plug their nozzle into their gas tank and fill up and, you know, swipe the credit card and go on with their mission. If you can do something that becomes a standardized piece of the infrastructure, then you may have something here. But if it's something that is a single mission thing for NASA, for example, I don't see that as being a really practical way to go.
Paul?
Yeah, there are technical issues with depots, as there are with anything new in space that we've tried to do. I would characterize the questions about depots and their feasibility sort of at the same point where the actual state of Orbital Rendezvous was before Gemini. We know it's possible in principle, but we haven't actually demonstrated it. So that means that there will be learning problems along the way, but I don't think there's anything in there that we won't be able to lick ultimately. Yeah, it is true that you have considerations that there are problems with keeping cryogens and boiling off. I think one way you can mitigate a lot of these is to transport the stuff as water, either from Earth's surface as water to orbit and then crack it in space. I mean, we're going to have to do that on the moon, so we might as well start learning how to do that in low Earth orbit, and there's no reason why you couldn't. So what I would do is I transport water to the depot and then manufacture the cryogens on site, and I wouldn't do that until I was exactly ready to use them, and that sort of solves the boil-off problem. But in any event, you're going to have to learn these skills. I mean, if this is something that we want to learn how to do, we want to learn how to routinely move through space, and one of the requirements for doing that is to develop depot technology, then we will develop that technology and we'll learn how to do it. And that's just a mission requirement.
Okay, and that would include aerobraking, which he mentioned too. If it's needed, you learn how to do it.
Yeah, aerobraking is just a special case of aerothermal entry, all right? You just
right.
Slow your approach speed down enough through atmospheric braking to get caught into orbit. And there's nothing magical about it. We've done it at Mars. We've done it at Venus. There's no reason why we couldn't do it at the Earth. And it's the fact that it hasn't been done doesn't mean that it's an insurmountable problem. It's just another thing that we have to demonstrate, a new skill we have to acquire.
We have time for the second part of this question. Is there a growing consensus among the space leaders that the next logical step is the development of cislunar space? How necessary is a more formally organized group of space leaders advocating this, and how do we go from here? How do we move forward from here?
Well, so, if space leaders refers to the political leadership, as in administration and Congress, then the answer is no. There is not a recognition of this. As we mentioned earlier, there are some folks within NASA who are looking along these lines. But if we're talking about the political leadership, no, the thinking is still in the old destination-driven paradigm, where, well, we're going to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and that's about as far as the vision goes, and does not really have a fully fleshed out purpose for all of this beyond creating jobs in particular districts. So the short answer on that is no. Political leadership still has a learning curve on this that they need to go through.
Any thoughts on you on this, Paul?
Yeah, I agree with that. It's not high visibility now because it hasn't really been brought together in this form until fairly recently. Everyone has talked about a piece of this at one point or another in the past, and certainly it was always part of the von Braun architecture to basically have routine operations from LEO to the moon. But I think the idea, the thing that's changed, the thing that is different now than from before, is that we now know that the moon has the resources that allow us to do this on a sustainable basis, and that we didn't know for sure. We suspected it might be possible, but we didn't know for certain that it was possible. And now we do. So I think it is worth looking at again from the perspective of this new information and to try to see how it all fits together. And so that's sort of what I'm advocating, and I'm spreading the word as best I can. And if anyone else wants to, I urge you to join us and do the same.
It's always fun to be a Monday night quarterback and look back, right? So if President Bush, instead of proposing return to the moon, had proposed cislunar development and then onward to Mars and the solar system, do you think that would have flown better with financing, funding, maybe different technological architecture rather than constellation? Do you think that might have been a better way of phrasing it and going forward?
Yeah, I would say so. That I saw that as a missed opportunity. I was tuned into the webcast of his speech in January of 2004, hoping for the best. And then when he finished speaking, I said, "What is that?" It and I really thought it was a missed opportunity that he could have brought this onto the national scene at that point. It would have been. Since he had chosen to go this far anyway, this would have been the perfect time to do that. But instead, he basically just repeated what his father had proposed 15 years earlier, which didn't go anywhere.
Who were his advisors?
I think that would have been an advantage if he had instituted it at that point, and maybe there wouldn't have been the dramatic change or need for change when the administration's changed.
Who were the advisors that created Return to the Moon? I don't remember.
Wait a minute. Let me take issue with this perspective. I think that the original announcement of the vision for space exploration was exactly what we are advocating. When that speech was given, if you go back and read the speech, you can find it at SpaceRef, Keith Cowing's site, the original Bush speech, he outlines exactly what we're going to do and why we're going to do it. And the reason he outlines that we're going to the moon after completing station, we're going back to the moon, and the reason is to learn to live there for increasing periods of time and use the resources of the moon to create new capability. That is exactly what I'm advocating. That was what the vision was about. That was the goal of the vision from the very beginning. Now, what happened was that when NASA got a hold of this, it was a 900-word speech, and the moon was mentioned 11 times. The only word they heard was Mars, and that was mentioned twice. And they turned what was a program designed to learn how to establish a presence on the moon, a sustainable, permanent presence, they turned it into Apollo to Mars, and moon became the Gemini to that Apollo. So in actual fact, the original vision for space exploration was about exactly what we've just been talking about creating new capabilities, going to the moon and learning to use the resources there, and then once we had done that, staging a Mars mission, a mission to the planets from that capability. So that was the vision for space exploration, and that was the mission statement that was thrown away in 2010 when Obama canceled the Constellation program.
But
you're reading far more into it than it was actually in there. If you go and look at the Bush's space exploration policy that was issued the same day. It's none of that is in there. It's really vague. It has the Mars goal in there. It doesn't say anything about developing resources on the moon. It's really very vague.
I was on the commission, the Aldrich Commission that Bush established the day the vision was announced, and if you read our report, we specifically mentioned going to the moon to learn how to use the resources of the moon. That was part of the vision. That was part of our report.
In the Aldrich report. Okay, well, see, that's different.
It was in Bush's speech, and we took our cue from Bush's speech. Marburger understood it that way, and we understood it that way.
But it got lost somehow over the years.
It did get lost because there were a lot of people at NASA who wanted to do Apollo to Mars, and that's all they heard. So they didn't implement the vision as outlined. They implemented the vision as they wanted to do it. And it wasn't just, and this is not a Griffin thing. This actually started well before Mike came to NASA. It was people in NASA at the AA level and below who did this.
And what did
a lot of them are still there.
What did Congress want to do? Yeah. Did they want to fund the mission to Mars or cislunar space development?
Congress didn't fully appreciate the subtleties of this. You know, they saw the big motherhood statements, and it was good with them because they were concerned that NASA didn't have a long-term direction. But the fact is that there were people in Congress on the Hill who were very supportive of the idea of developing lunar resources and developing space. And I testified before the Senate Space Subcommittee and before the House Space Subcommittee, and the chairmanship of those two committees and many of the membership understood exactly what the purpose was, and they were supportive of it.
So this would seem to me to be a terrific lesson learned if any administration is going to propose an effective space policy, be it cislunar or who knows what, that the clarity and the supporting documentations and the ability to make sure that the mission being proposed is actually understood and the one that gets worked on is absolutely crucial, because I know even to the space community, when I was doing shows on this back in the time on the VSC, you know, there were people that all saw it differently. I mean, it was hard to have a uniform view of what was being proposed and how to implement it and how to get it there. What was uniform was nobody thought it would survive multiple congressional, you know, one-year funding bouts because the money was never there initially, and they didn't think Congress was ever going to keep anteing up for it. So everybody sort of thought down the road it'll be eventually canceled, which, of course, it was. So
one of the things that we recommended that was not taken was to reestablish a space council, which would effectively be answerable to the executive office of the president and would periodically review NASA's implementation of the vision. And the idea there was to prevent exactly what happened, to prevent the idea that the agency could take this in a direction that wasn't intended to go, or that it was getting off track, or it was giving the wrong emphasis. And of course, NASA didn't like that idea, and that was the one that went. That was the idea that got swept under the rug the quickest. But we anticipated that this might have happened, and we offered a way to avoid that problem, but that wasn't taken up.
I got one last question, if you can stay for an extra couple of minutes to answer it, from Clara, who is in Palo Alto. And Clara says there's been a recent proposal by several members of the House to revamp our space program, including a 10-year term for the NASA administrator, a review committee like Paul just talked about, plus some other changes, including multi-year funding for these long-duration space projects. Do you think that bill should be passed? Is it a good way to go? Anyone want to comment on that?
Well, this is the same question that we got 3 weeks ago when I was on your show. And as I said back then, I like the part about the multi-year funding, but I'm not confident that the suggestions in this bill are going to improve the management of NASA, and I'm not sure that they'd be able to find anybody who's willing to take on leadership of the agency on a 10-year term. Because it's tough enough to find somebody for shorter periods of time to head up the agency. So I'm pretty skeptical about most of what's in the bill, either being able, well, certainly I don't think it would pass in the first place, but that it would be any significant improvement even if it were passed.
Paul, do you have any thoughts on that, Bill?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I think the idea, its motivation comes from this whipsawing that we see of NASA, where that one administration will start it on a path and another one will come in and change the direction orthogonal or sometimes even 180 degrees opposite phase. And there was an attempt to design in some stability in terms of leadership and strategic direction. So it's laudable from that perspective. I don't know if the solution they've come up with is the way to do that. I think it's worth looking at. I certainly think that bill ought to have hearings and go through the process of legislation just to see how that all shakes out. I'm not convinced that it's the answer, but it's certainly something to consider and worth considering, I think.
I wouldn't like a 10-year term for anybody in government, but that's another issue. Gentlemen, real quickly.
We do that with the head of the FBI, and I think that was the model. But the FBI has a very clearly defined mission, and unless you're going to give NASA something like that, it doesn't quite – they're not quite analogous.
Yeah. Right. I wouldn't mind a staggered term of 4 years like the Federal Reserve Chief or something like that, It transcends the election cycle for president, but all to be determined. How about a quick closing comment or a pearl of wisdom from each of you as we are over time and we'll be closing down the program? Jim, since you went first, Paul, do you want to go first with a closing comment?
Sure. I'll just thank you again for hosting us. This is always a great discussion, and I appreciate the audience's questions and their interest in this topic. I think that the direction that we've been talking about, the goals of establishing a long-term infrastructure in cislunar space, have immense value both economically and culturally for our country. Effectively, if we want to become a spacefaring nation, we want to be able to call ourselves a spacefaring nation, we need to start learning how to use what we find in space to create new capabilities. And the way to do that is to do that in our own backyard, first, and then in other people's backyards next. And our backyard happens to be cislunar space. And we're very fortunate that we have a moon that has not only the material and energy resources we need, but in the form we need them, so close and accessible. And we can demonstrate and learn how to use these assets in a responsible way right in our own backyard. Once we've done that, once we've established our presence in cislunar and our ability to create these new capabilities, nothing will stop us from going to the planets, and in fact, we'll be able to go to the planets on a long-term, sustainable basis instead of a simple Apollo-type plant-the-flag-and-rush-home kind of mission. So that's my parting thought, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Jim, real quickly from you, please.
Okay, well, I concur with what Paul just said, and just a little historical note. We all like to think back of the pioneering work of Lewis and Clark and how that opened up the American West. Those guys came back from their trip in 1806, and they came back as heroes, but they were quickly forgotten. They didn't even make it into the history books until the 20th century, and they both went to their graves thinking that they had failed because nothing was happening. Well, things started happening a little later. Why? Because infrastructure finally started to make it out into the new territories, mainly in the form of railroads and the telegraph. So things really start to happen. You really start to make a difference when you start building out that infrastructure. And that started to happen around the middle of the 19th century in the development of the American West. And I think what will really start to push us ahead in space development is when we get serious about a sustained development and sustained operations of a cislunar space infrastructure. So let's all learn from history and do it right.
Thank you very much to both Paul Spoutis and Jim Betta. I appreciate your being with us. That's it for today, listeners. Back Sunday with our regular Sunday Space Show program. Goodbye from Dr. Spoutis, Dr. Betta, and the Space Show.